It's time for the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Coming up on the show here today, Taylor Charlstrom will be talking about the basics of trunk injection in tree crops. And I'll have a check-in of national and regional agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
In a letter to Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Western growers and other leading business organizations requested that the net investment income tax, which primarily impacts small and family-run businesses, not be expanded in the face of a possible recession, 40-year high inflation, unprecedented supply chain challenges, and chronic labor shortages. Raising taxes on small, individually, and family-owned businesses is the wrong approach and should be rejected, according to the letter. According to recent media reports, two tax increases under consideration would fall entirely on small, individually, and family-owned, closely held businesses. One is expanding the 3.8% net investment income tax to individuals and families who actively participate in their business, and two, limiting the ability of small, individually, and family-owned businesses to fully deduct their losses during an economic downturn by expanding and extending the so-called excess business loss limitation for non-corporate taxpayers. Combined, these would increase revenues by more than $400 billion over 10 years, shouldered entirely on the backs of small, individually, and family-owned businesses. Western Growers points out that they led a successful agricultural industry effort to prevent Congress from meddling with family farm taxes, including long-standing estate tax benefits. They said they will continue to monitor and engage on this important effort. California pear season is here, and picking, packing, and shipping has started, with the first pears of the season coming from Cortland in the Sacramento Delta region. It is a timely start, largely due to good growing conditions, according to Chris Ford with Viva Tierra Organic. He says this year's River Delta weather has been beneficial for pears, and they're expanding clean fruit as a result. Bartlett is the main pear variety grown in California. Harvest starts in a river district, and later in the season, it moves north to Mendocino and Lake counties. Between the two growing regions, there should be continuous supplies of organic Bartlett's from now through mid-September. The northern counties allow the California pear season to be extended into September, which will make for a nice transition with the beginning of the Washington season, according to Ford. Due to good crop outlook, varieties are expected to be available in a nice size of ranges. Smaller sizes work well for pouch bags, while larger pears will be sold in cartons, and they expect to have promotable volumes available for both, according to Ford. He is expecting strong demand for California pears, as the state will be the only producer in the market. The import season is done, and Washington is late this year due to colder weather. As a result, California will stand alone. California pears will be available in California-specific branding. In the past, the brand had a strong presence in the West, but has expanded across North America in recent years. California branded pears appeal to retailers as well as consumers across the United States and into Canada, with the northern neighbors being a very important part of the program. And coming up soon, harvest of California Gala apples is expected to start. Right now, they are receiving the last import apples of later varieties like Crips Pink, but the import season is winding down quickly. Just like pears, California's Gala apples are expected to play an important role this year, as Washington had a short crop. Viva Tierra expects to have a good mix of core varieties available. In addition to Gala, these include Fuji, Granny Smith, and Crips Pink. California citrus growers voted to continue their support of the Citrus Research Board by a broad margin in a state-mandated referendum. The just-concluded referendum, which must be held every 5 years, was conducted by the California Department of Food and Agriculture. A majority of eligible citrus producers cast their vote, and their support was nearly unanimous at 97.80%, representing 99.51% of the state's citrus volume voted in favor of continuing the research board. CDFA Marketing Branch Chief Joe Monson said since the referendum results exceed the criteria required for continuation, the department has authorized the program to continue operating for another five-year period through September 30th of 2027. Over the past 5 years, the research board has worked continuously to advance findings within four research priorities that includes vector diseases, pest management, production, and post-harvest technology, and new varieties. The research board administers the California Citrus Research Program, the grower-funded and grower-directed program established in 1968 under the California Marketing Act, as the mechanism enabling the state citrus producers to sponsor and support needed research. And a reminder now, the California Department of Food and Agriculture is extending the application period for the 2022 Beginning Farmer and Farm Worker Training and Workforce Development Program. The agency is now accepting grant applications until August 15th at 5 p.m. in order to allow sufficient time for applicant organizations to connect with partnering organizations to submit proposals. The program was funded through the 2021 California General Fund budget. It will provide support to organizations to enhance or expand beginning farmer and farm worker training and apprenticeship programs. For more information, log on to cdfa.ca.gov/BFFTP. San Francisco-based Grub Market has announced it has completed the acquisition of Albuquerque, New Mexico and El Paso, Texas-based Quality Fruit and Vegetable Company, a highly respected fresh produce company that provides the highest quality fruits and vegetables to the Southwest, sourced from the U.S., Mexico, South America, and other parts of the world. QF&V currently operates in Texas and New Mexico, selling tens of millions of dollars of produce to hundreds of retail and food service customers across the U.S. and Mexico each year, and has a strong reputation as an industry leader in traceability and food practices. Founded over 35 years ago, QF&V is run by the original owner, Nick Delgado, a well-known veteran in the fresh produce industry with over 55 years of experience in the fresh food space. QF&V is a full-service food distribution and wholesale business with warehouse operations covering nearly 70,000 square feet, including state-of-the-art cold storage and air-ripening facilities. It has an extensive product catalog that includes specialty and seasonal items, but is particularly well-known for bananas, lettuce, and tomatoes. In addition, QF&V has been at the forefront of food safety and traceability, having received top food safety certifications from Primus Labs and other organizations. After the acquisition, the business will continue to be managed by its current experienced and mission-driven leadership. As part of Grub Market's portfolio, QF&V will now utilize Grub Market's innovative and proprietary wholesale ware software suite, the company's software as a service platform that provides food industry wholesalers and distributors with seamless financial management, easy-to-use sales and online ordering features, precise inventory management, lot traceability and tracking, grower accounting, and automated routing and logistics tools.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
Trunk injection is a targeted delivery of pesticides, insecticides, nutrients, or other plant protection materials into the stem or trunk of woody plants as an alternative to spraying or soil drenching. Trunk injection has historically been used for disease and pest management of high-value forest tree species or ornamental plants when aerial applications are problematic due to spatial problems and health-related concerns. But an interest in using the injection technique for protection of agricultural crops in commercial production systems has emerged more recently, where foliar applications and soil drenches have proven ineffective or pose environmental hazards. Lee Archer, a researcher in the Horticultural Sciences Department at Southwest Florida Research and Education Center, is part of current research that is looking at just that.
I would say the modern take on trunk injection research sort of started to ramp up with Dutch elm disease back in, you know, the mid-1900s. And since then, it's really started to gain a lot of popularity, especially when you have these really devastating pests or diseases where there isn't necessarily an easy solution. So take, for example, HLB or Huanglongbing citrus greening, which is what I'm focusing down here in Florida at the University of Florida. And so Huanglongbing is not easily managed. There's no cure right now. And the only, or one of the few methods that growers have been seeing, or that researchers have been seeing any kind of efficacy against the pathogen causing Huanglongbing is through trunk injection, because the pathogen itself is located within the phloem of the tree, it's really hard for foliar applied compounds or soil drenches to actually attack the bacteria causing, or the bacteria that's associated with HLB. And so that's why trunk injection has become a lot more, it's become, growers down in Florida are becoming very interested in it due to the severity of HLB and the thought that trunk injection is one of those few methods that is actually showing some efficacy against the bacteria.
Archer admitted that the practice of injecting a chemical or substance into the flesh of a tree's trunk sounds dystopian and somewhat scary, but the reality is that the process allows for a more streamlined application of a product and reduces the amount of said product that is released into the environment. Archer and her colleagues recently published a research paper detailing all of the basics a grower should know about trunk injection when considering its use as a tool for delivering plant protection materials.
Growers really need to think about is the dosage. They need to think about all of the typical stuff, but also the effects that trunk injection is going to have on wounding. So it is going to create some sort of injury or some sort of damage. And so when you think about how a tree is going to respond to that wounding, you need to be aware when we're thinking about HLB, is the wounding or the damage itself that's being caused by trunk injection, is that going to be worse than what's being caused by HLB? Because right now, without many other feasible options for HLB management, we might have to just, we might have to move towards a point where the damage caused by trunk injection is something that is acceptable compared to the alternative. So one of the big concepts that we talk about in this paper is wounding and wound response. And there's a lot of research that has been done in forest trees about this compartmentalization of decay in trees. And that's basically how a tree is actually really good at healing itself. But when we start applying chemicals into that heal, into that injection port, that's where the tree kind of, you're going to reduce the ability for it to heal itself. So what we want everyone to think about, and we need further research on, is how can we create a formulation or a compound or a chemical that's going to be less damaging in terms of wounding, but is still going to be effective at managing HLB in our cases. So trunk injection, wounding, those kind of go hand in hand, and that's a big concern for growers. But other things growers need to think about is the timing, just like you would with any sort of pesticide application. You need to think about the timing, when it's going to be effective. And there needs to be, in terms of HLB, there needs to be a lot more research on exactly what when compounds need to be applied, where in the tree, what specifically those formulations need to be. And there's been a lot of interest in antibiotics or bactericides because the pathogen causing HLB is a bacteria. But we can also, we have some preliminary research looking at the application of insecticides, or there's research out there that uses things like double-stranded RNA and other molecular techniques. So although a lot of this research has been focusing on the use of bactericides, there's definitely a lot of potential for incorporating other less controversial compounds, for lack of a better term, and compounds that may prove just as effective without any sort of, you know, residue or residual activity.
As Archer said, there is the potential for the chemical or substance to wound the tree, but there's also the potential for the physical application method to wound the tree. A concern had right now in California with stem water potential sensors that get stuck into the trees. Archer said her and her colleagues are working on improving this situation for growers as well.
The trunk injection itself has typically been used on these giant forest tree species, where if you drill one small hole into a tree, it's fine with it. That's a tiny amount of the tree. When we're thinking about citrus trees or any other type of commercial orchard, those trees themselves are much, much smaller. And so the amount of wounding you're going to get from each of those injection devices that are currently available is a lot greater. So when we talk about optimizing trunk injection for commercial orchards, a big focus of that is going to have to be on reducing the size of the injection wound and making sure that the compounds that are being applied are still being taken up by the tree effectively.
One other thing to keep in mind, according to Archer, the chemical that needs to be applied to the tree must be labeled for trunk injection in order to be used for trunk injection. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Charlstrom.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
A Federal Reserve official told Congress the ag economy may be headed for a slowdown later this year or early next year. Nathan Kaufman told House ag lawmakers that farm credit conditions have strengthened during the last 2 years with rising commodity prices and land values. But Kaufman says the war in Ukraine has changed the economic landscape.
While the strength of farm income these past 2 years is likely to sustain credit conditions in agriculture for some time, some borrowers may face heightened financial stress in the year ahead if costs continue to rise and commodity prices ease further.
Kaufman says the U.S. farm sector seems well positioned financially for the rest of the year.
But some measures do appear to have softened in recent weeks, and some producers may face more substantial credit challenges than others.
In a word, economic conditions are uncertain.
Uncertainty about the outlook for the U.S. agricultural economy is high and will depend significantly on global factors, particularly the war in Ukraine and the strength of global economic activity.
Kaufman says the war has had a direct impact on the price of commodities and on fuel and fertilizer inputs, creating market uncertainty, volatility, and lender concerns as farm margins tighten. USA is calling for grant applications for projects designed to expand online shopping options for participants of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. USA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
Recipients of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits have been able to shop online for over 2 years. Yet, as Rebecca Piazza of USDA's Food and Nutrition Service points out,
up until now, we've seen online shopping mostly offered by larger retailers that already had mature online shopping capabilities.
Now, FNS is seeking applications for competitive grants to expand the number of retailers offering SNAP online shopping.
So, looking to work with smaller mom and pop shops, regional stores, helping them either get online for online shopping if they aren't doing that today, or helping them meet SNAP requirements if they're offering online shopping but haven't gone through the hoops to be able to expand that online shopping to SNAP retailers.
$5 million in grant monies will be available through this application process, going on until September 6th, with grants awarded this fall. More information and application forms are available via www.grants.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And California is not the only state experiencing drought conditions. While the western U.S. sees water getting scarcer every day, extremely dry conditions are getting worse in central and in eastern states. The U.S. Drought Monitor says a flash drought has developed in parts of the south and northeast, including Texas, Oklahoma, and Missouri. CNN says a flash drought is caused by the rapid intensification of a drought due to a combination of unusually high temperatures, sunshine, and wind. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says flash drought can cause extensive damage to agriculture, economies, and ecosystems. Extreme heat has covered the southern plains for the past couple of weeks, and more is in the forecast. That's made the ongoing drought much worse. Roughly 94% of Texas was in some form of drought last week, the largest area since 2013, and over 21% of the state is in exceptional drought. Oklahoma is also experiencing its hottest summer in several years. Farmers have a love-hate relationship with nitrogen. It's an important nutrient needed to achieve big yields, but it's also a leaky fertilizer that can pollute water. Corteva Agriscience announced the formation of a new nutrient maximizer team to help educate farmers and others about the value of using nitrogen stabilizers to keep more applied nitrogen in fields and out of waterways. Now's the perfect time to form the team because of high commodity and fertilizer prices. And with environmental conversations heating up, Brittany Lowen, Nutrient Maximize sales leader, says she thinks retaining fertilizer is on everyone's radar. She says it's an exciting time and they have a solution. They're proud to be able to deliver that to the American farmer. A new bill hit the floor recently as the Agriculture, Natural Resource, and Science, Space, and Technology committees came together to address greenhouse gas capture and storage. According to a joint release, the Carbon Sequestration Collaboration Act aims to increase agriculture and forestry's current 13% carbon capture rate by establishing more research and development programs in land use. Representative Frank Lucas, a Republican from Oklahoma, Science, Space, and Technology committee member who sponsored the bill introduction, says as a farmer and rancher, he is well aware of the role that quality and practices can play in conserving natural resources to improve the environment. The Department of Energy is already doing great research on large-scale carbon sequestration opportunities, but there is a knowledge gap when it comes to making use of smaller carbon sinks like soils and rangeland, he says. He also went on to say that we need an all-of-the-above approach to addressing climate change, one that makes use of our many resources. Ag Committee member Glenn Thompson from Pennsylvania, Republican, echoed Lucas's remarks, saying that the bill directs federal agencies to work together and is needed in the carbon space.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
A study that was recently published found winter honeybees to be more resistant to a widely used pesticide, imidacloprid, than newly emerged summer bees. Mohamed Albaraki, a research entomologist with the USDA ARS who works at the Bee Research Laboratory in Maryland, gives us more background on this pesticide and how it affects bees.
Imidacloprid, in fact, it is a molecule widely used in the world and particularly in the US, is a molecule of the neonicotinoids, and it's pretty famous. And generally speaking, the neonicotinoids are insecticides with high toxicity for insects. So they are made basically to target insects. And honeybees are also insects. So here is the challenge. The challenge is that when farmers are using their pest management control, they use insecticides to treat the pests on their crops. And one of those widely used molecules is the imidacloprid. So imidacloprid is not new. It has been a concern for beekeepers for many, many years. In the US and in the EU, they've started to see significant impact of the neonicotinoids in general on pollinators or insect pollinators.
The study conducted was unique as it did not just focus on the toxicity of imidacloprid, but also focused on the bee's behavior. Albaraki brings us more details about the methods of the study.
The study had different components in it. It was not a regular toxicological study in which we really just see how the imidacloprid is killing bees. Eventually, if you feed them imidacloprid, they're going to die. So this study was not really oriented to determine the level of the toxicity, or what we call the LD50, the dose that will kill half of the population tested. You know, this is very important. This study is very, in my opinion, is very special because we studied how bees are behaving vis-a-vis imidacloprid in terms of diet behavior and affinity to the content of the food provided to bees. That is the aspect here. Beside that, the experimental design was made to test those two aspects with imidacloprid and non-imidacloprid, with two different concentrations of imidacloprid on three different categories of bees, phenotypes, we call them. In fact, there are three. They are not just summer bees and winter bees. So we have winter bees, the bees that will be during the winter season, maintaining the cluster heat and the hive. Those, they don't forage usually. And the summer bees, the one that we are seeing now in the field. But those summer bees also, we tested two different categories. One category is the summer bees emerged in natural condition, like in the hive. You open a hive, you got summer new baby bees basically born in the hive. But when we experiment on bees, in fact, there is like a lot, there are a lot of studies in which we hatch bees in incubators. So we take the baby bees before they hatch from the frame, we hatch them in incubators. And then we experiment on those bees. So those bees are quite different in than compared to the bees that are hatching in their own native colonies. So we tested these two categories within the summer bees.
This study focused on the behavioral patterns of three different categories of bees, and the findings reflect that. The results of this study will be beneficial to scientists and beekeepers alike when considering future research and care practices.
So first, it was very important to answer to the main question, which is not really how imidacloprid is killing bees, because we all know the LD50 for bees is 13 ppb for this particular molecule. And in European studies, it's the average of toxicity in their study is 3 to 50 nanogram per bees. So we know that this is not new. What is new here really and interesting for beekeepers and for scientists alike is the behavior of these three different categories. Let's like make it more simple. The two phenotype category, the summer bees and the winter bee, when they face food content or diet tainted with or contaminated, I would say here in the field with the imidacloprid molecule. So our study showed that the winter bees would always prefer to consume the diet with imidacloprid, whether it's at 5 ppb or 20 ppb. And that's a little bit scary because it means they are preferring the contaminated food. While the summer bees in general, they were definitively avoiding at all cost the contaminated food, and they were just looking for the controlled syrup, the clean syrup, which means in a certain way that if faced in the field, eventually winter bees, they don't forage, as I told you, but they tend to go out a little bit in the early beginning of the spring season, very early beginning, and also end of the fall season. So they might be also at risk, but there is also another aspect here is the inside contamination. When they consume pollen throughout the winter time, mainly syrup, but they can also consume pollen or honey contaminated with this molecule. So basically they would prefer to have the consumption from the contaminated syrup, which will elevate their risk of exposure to the pesticide and higher mortality. While summer bees, which is good news for beekeepers, in fact, at least in the category we've tested, you know, because we've tested bees from 18 day old. After that, we don't know what's going to happen, but mainly they will become fully active foragers. So while the foragers at early stages, they were avoiding the contaminated source of syrup.
Albaraki said it is vital for producers, beekeepers, scientists, and other groups to keep communicating about pesticides and bees. Collaboration between these groups can ensure that each group succeeds.
So One really recommendation that I always in my outreach and extension work, I ask everybody to work together. Farmers, crop producers, beekeepers, association, even pesticide corporations who provide those chemicals for farmers and for everybody. Nowadays, you know, we need those chemicals, those insecticides, and I think everybody should work together to use them wisely and when needed, and by the label. You know, this is very important because farmers, they can't grow their crops, they can't have their business. We can't feed the population across the world without pest management control. But the collaboration and the joining force together between farmers and beekeepers is very important. For example, when farmers would like to spray, they should be aware that if there is any beekeepers around the area, that especially on cotton or soybean or orchards, those are extremely toxic pesticide. I mean, the LD50 at 13 ppb is like, it is very, very low, you know. So this will damage the business of beekeeping just as a business. I'm not talking about the ecological effect and the impact on the ecosystems. But the collaboration and strong communication between farmers and beekeepers is always required. Like this, both parties can have their...
This is Kylie Harlan reporting for My Ag Life.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.